The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, midweek action ahoy at the Etihad. Man City triumph in rare sighting of Stoke without fire. At St James's Park, it's Bar then Humbug as Maggie's beaten by Baggies. And at Ewood Park, Blackburn Bolton, the game with more riding on it than Santa's sleigh, including perhaps the sack for someone. We round it all up, preview the post-Christmas action, hear more on the Dutch keeper-kicker controversy, dial up Sid, and discover why Cristiano Doni was hiding behind his Porsche. All this on your special Not Back Till Next Thursday Football Weekly Extra. Hi, everybody. It's a festive atmosphere here inside the Football Weekly pod with mince pies and satsumas and Sean Ingle.
Hello, Jim. I noticed you've got two mince pies.
Well, yeah, because Jacob Steinberg, hello, Jacob, hello. Gave me his. Not a mince pie fan, Jacob.
No, but I'm liking the satsumas.
Right. Is it a Christmas thing, you being Jewish and that?
Yeah, we've never really had mince pies.
Right, okay. Yeah. What do you have for Hanukkah? Do you have something for that?
What do you have? You have chocolate coins for Hanukkah.
Right, that's pretty specifically.
Yeah, and Lutkers.
Of course. Yeah. All right. Jonathan Wilson.
All right.
For now, but not for long, because you've got a train to catch.
Yeah, late caller, but it was on my way home, quite literally.
Right. So, home for Christmas.
Yeah.
Like Cliff in the song.
Sunderland v Everton, and I've had some music reference I don't understand. But yeah, Sunderland v Everton on Boxing Day. Always the highlight of the year.
Wasn't it Chris Rea rather than...
He was driving home for Christmas. Jonathan's taking the train.
Oh.
Cliff Richard, Sir Cliff, said, home for Christmas, catch a plane, get a train, or something like that. He was a lot more...
I got the tube, then the train.
Right, oh, there you go. Anyway, the important thing is we all have a super Christmas. And what a cracking midweek round of games, eh? So much to talk about today. On the field, off the field. Going to start off with that plucky Man City side, who've only gone and topped the table at Christmas for the first time since 1929, against Stoke. Now, I love the comment from Mancini afterwards. It's usually difficult to play Stoke. Why wasn't it this time?
Because City are so good, basically.
Was that all? It did seem as though Stoke didn't really bother turning up for this one. 924 passes Man City put together, which is a Premier League record since in the last 8-9 years. Man City fans screaming shoot whenever Stoke had the ball. Did they ever manage a shot on goal?
Well, I was at the United game last night, so I only saw the highlights. But I think it's worth pointing out that City now have 44 points from 17 games. And that's more than Arsenal's Invincibles at the same stage. They had 39. It's more than Chelsea in the first season under Mourinho, which was 40 points. It's more even than the fabulous Liverpool side of 87-88, who had 43 points in the first 17 games. We perhaps are underplaying just how good City and Mancini being, because people talk about Balotelli, people talk about Tevez, they're clearly difficult people to handle. But Adam Johnson isn't the easiest person to deal with, nor is Yaya Toure, nor is Nigel de Jong at the moment. And I think Mancini has done very well to keep what could have been a very fractious squad together. And also he's got them playing the sort of football I didn't expect them to play, having watched them a lot last season.
Fair point.
I think there's an element with City as well. It's, I think all great teams take on this sort of aura. And so you go behind against them, you heads drop, you think, what's the point? We might as well save up for Boxing Day rather than, you know, running ourselves silly, chasing a game we're not going to get back into.
Boxing Day, when Stoke will be hosting Aston Villa,
who I think they'll probably expect to be able to beat, given Villa's form at the moment.
Well, indeed. Man City, is that enough on them? Or do you want to move on to that United team who are still just 2 points behind them?
Yeah, the thing about United is that when they've got Valencia back in the team, they just have a better tempo about them, and the best way United have played for about the last 5 years, you know, is when they've played at a quick tempo and kept it going throughout the 90 minutes. You know, if you look at the 06-07 season when they had Saha in the team alongside Rooney and they had Ronaldo on the wings, and they just played at a pace that people couldn't handle, and that's what they've started to do again, because they were looking a bit slow, a bit stodgy for a couple of months, but in the QPR game they could have scored a hatful. Last night they did. Very impressive.
Also, Valencia gives them much greater width. Yeah. If you've got Nani on one side and Ashley Young on the other, everything sort of funnels into a point at the top. Whereas if you have Valencia on one side, you have a winger on one side who cuts in, and a winger on the other side who stays wide and gets very, very good crosses in.
For Rooney, who loves him.
For Rooney, who scores hundreds of goals from Valencia crosses.
Sean, you were at Craven Cottage last
night. Yeah, I love Craven Cottage. It's probably my favourite Premier League ground. I don't know what everyone else thinks.
I walked past it yesterday, just probably mid-afternoon, just as it was starting to go dark, and thought, that's what a football ground should look like.
Yeah. The sun setting over the Michael Jackson statue. It's
exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But there were carol singers last night, and you walked through Bishop's Park.
What were they singing, Sean?
I can't remember. God rest you,
Merry. Do they know at Christmas?
God rest you, Merry Gentlemen, I think. And right. I think Al Fayed was walking nearby. But and United were brilliant. They, as Jacob said, they played with a sort of pace that we haven't seen. It was United of mid-August and early September. Mm. I think it was interesting that even when Jones went off, you know, Fergie knew that they Fulham were there for the taking, and he put on Ashley Young, and they just cut through them. And I thought Welbeck, is worth pointing out, played very well. I think Carrick was very smart as well. There's people will say though Carrick can do it against Fulham, he can't do it in the very big games, but they were great last night.
Even Dimitar Berbatov, it was lovely to see Dimitar getting that cheeky back heel goal and that sort of rueful smile on his face, wasn't it endearing?
It was, yeah. No, I'm.
We all feel. Do we all feel for Dimitar Berbatov?
Yeah, I do. He's one of the very few footballers with a great sense of self-irony. Hmm. That he, you know, he can be very arrogant at times, but I think it is undercut by a realization that the whole thing is slightly ludicrous and it's ridiculous. He gets paid what he does to do what he does, and he
or not do what he doesn't.
Well,
do.
Yeah. I find him. Yeah, the odd time I've interviewed him, I find him very engaging. I think he's, you know, he's a very very smart bloke who sort of gets it.
Is the impression that his well-remunerated exile from first-team football at Old Trafford about to come to an end in the January window?
Unless I think United get an awful lot of money for him, I think he will stay, because I don't think Berbatov is desperate to leave. He's on a lot of money. I think Ferguson's happy to keep him. I mean, he's
what
not
a waste, though. I'd love to see Dimitar Berbatov playing somewhere.
No, I would too, but I think as long as the player's not making, you know, the hissy fits and demands wanting to go, and if a club isn't going to come in and pay, what, at least 15 million for him, probably.
Yeah. How long have you got left in his contract?
I think his contract's up soon, though. Anyway. Well, it was lovely to see him. And, yes, his kind of rather shy celebrations after.
I don't quite understand why he hasn't played more, because it's not like United are overwhelmed with attacking options. And if you played him, it would like to play Rooney deeper. And they clearly are short of creativity in midfield. Yeah. And yeah, McCabe has done nothing particularly this season. So when Welbeck was injured, I'm not really sure. And with Chicharito being injured as well, I'm not sure why he wasn't sort of a first choice there.
I guess if you look at how they played last night with Welbeck and Danny who was on the left,
Valencia was on the right.
If you look at how they played last night with Welbeck, Valencia, and Nani, they had that sort of the pace and the drive, and I think that sometimes with Berbatov they can look at
it can slow down a bit. That's true. Yeah.
It's like with
Jacob wants him to be, you know, pacey.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the problem there. And, of course, Sir Alex's big target is being number one on New Year's Day. And their next clash is against Wigan. We'll come on to
them. That was a slightly odd thing for him to say, because I think something like of the last 12 titles they've won, there's only four times they've been top on New Year's Day.
Also, they can't. They just have to rely on City losing.
Yeah, it just seemed to set a target that they might not make through no fault of their own. And why not just say that and try and put pressure on City by talking about, you know, come March, come April? Mm. I just thought it was a very odd thing for him to say.
I mean, that's the way United have done it in the past when they've hauled teams from behind. They stick with them through the grimy, grotty period where they're not playing particularly well, and then hope for hope to catch them the last 2 or 3 months.
What about the Phil Jones injury? He went off eventually with, what was it, concussion after the
broken cheekbone, I think. Yeah.
But he also, I think, was a bit.
He looked groggy, yeah.
Yeah. And they're talking about 6 weeks out. I thought in these days of high-tech carbon fibre masks.
Yeah. Well,
all right.
I'm not a doctor.
All right then, Jacob. Not a doctor. There you go. Any particular reason, Sean, or should we move on, why United, who hadn't managed to get a win there for three seasons, were able to get such a convincing goal haul this time?
I thought Fulham were really poor. Dembélé played okay. There were some flashes, I guess, in the second half from Andy Johnson. But the first half, the intensity wasn't there. And you speak to a couple of people at Fulham who say, you know, the players don't particularly get on with the manager. Like, obviously, that's quite clear with Zamora. But they didn't have that usual. And usually, I think Fulham are up for it against these big sides quite early on. And they didn't. And they let a goal in early. And they basically, by the second half, it was absolutely all over, and they tried a bit harder, but United were just several levels above them.
All right. Well, after Christmas on Boxing Day, Man United will be hosting Wigan at Old Trafford, a Wigan team that's put a remarkable recovery together of late. They did look well out of the picture, bottom of the table.
They always seem to do this, Wigan.
Wigan.
They go on these awful runs. Yeah, it was 3-4-3 last
which
night.
Which really seems... I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen them enough to kind of know why that would work particularly, but it does seem... That change does seem to really help them.
They were really
so
good
last
night as
well. That's been the change, right? Not just last night, but in the previous games as well.
I think the previous games,
against,
yeah.
They did it against Chelsea on Saturday.
So three at the back, which effectively means, what, five at the back? Because they were absolutely shocking in defence.
Well, no, they've got three central defenders,
right.
And then two central midfielders, and David Jones was playing on the left, and I think it was Stam on the right, and then kind of, not really three strikers, but three nominally up front.
Well, Jonathan Wilson was pronouncing that three at the back was dead a couple of years ago, but it's back to life, JW.
If you'd read what I said, what I said was that three at the back is not a useful formation against a lone striker system, unless you're using purely as a defensive tactic. That remains true.
Liverpool playing 4-4-2 last night. So,
exactly. Yeah. Three at the back against two strikers.
Yeah.
Were Chelsea playing? They were playing a lone striker.
They were. That's a paradox. But Wigan, I guess, would the argument would be they were deliberately doing it as a defensive tactic to have two spare men. If you're being proactive, you can't play three at the back against a lone striker system.
All right. Were Liverpool being proactive yesterday against Wigan?
They started off really well. For about half an hour, they were all over Wigan, and then just kind of fizzled out. It was very strange. And Wigan really came into it. And Victor Moses looks like a huge talent. He went on one brilliant run, took himself past about four Liverpool players and nearly scored.
It does go down easily. He got a penalty against Sunderland disgracefully. Well, it was a terrible dive last night.
Yeah. Does he not also do this a lot of doing incredible runs that almost finish really,
yeah,
really well?
Yeah, I think when he scored against West Brom a couple of weeks ago, it was... he'd had the most shots without scoring in the league.
Yeah, so you're suggesting like the Moses, he gets to his Pisgah heights and looks upon the promised land, and then
but
it's denied him at the last.
It. Right, so interesting.
So you say that, but you know, in 40 years' time, he will suddenly become.
No, because Moses never entered the promised land. He was taken up Pisgah Heights and shown it, but he wasn't allowed to enter the Promised Land.
Right, because they'd built a big wall across it. Was it or what?
No, I think he might have mixed that with modern day politics.
Oh, sorry. Right, topical reference, ahoy. Listen, you know, we just mentioned Wigan. What about Liverpool's extraordinary entrance there at the DW Stadium, wearing white T-shirts with Shea Suarez emblazoned on them, that iconic image? It's pretty interesting that this whole topic is a very, very difficult one to approach, because there's been this judgment, which surprised a lot of people on Monday. Mentioned the topic of a ban, people say, oh, I don't think there's going to be any ban at all. The fact that it is so big, I think, has driven people to really, in some cases, very extreme reactions. We do need to wait until the explanation for the FA's decision, or do we, Sean?
Well, I think you could say a couple of things. First of all, I'm very surprised by Liverpool's response to the verdict. I mean, the statement, it was very combative, to say the least. I was speaking to a former player last night who was black, who was saying that... however you look at it, you know, ever being called the word Negretto is a racist word. Now, you know, no one is saying that Suarez is a racist.
Right, now you've got Jonathan sucking his teeth, because in Uruguay it's not. The only thing is, Suarez, do you genuinely feel he didn't realise the implications of
I have no idea until we see the evidence. Yeah, I find it very hard to pronounce. You know. All I would say is, so far, you've had an independent panel has made a ruling.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they think there is enough evidence, so...
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we'll be able to judge that better when that evidence is presented to us. But
I think I'd have to agree.
It alarms me, people trying to second guess what that evidence might be.
I've spoken to a number of black players over the years who will tell you that even though things are an awful lot better than they were back in the day, there's an awful lot of this goes on. You know, again, one player pointed out there was a youth team game, you know, a year or so ago, where a player was called the N-word. And you know, he went back to his bench, told the bench, and they were like, and they, and one of them said to the manager, said to him, "You should report this." He said, "No, I don't want this to affect my career. I don't want it to become a case." And it's, you know, it's happened. And I think any example of racism, whether it ends up being this, or you know, whether John Terry, obviously, facetly denies making any racist remarks, but if he's proved to have done so, you know, they deserve the biggest possible punishments. And I think 8 games. You know, isn't unreasonable.
You mentioned John Terry, and of course that's a separate case, and with equally big implications. So the Crown Prosecution Service, I think I'm right in saying, wouldn't take it this far, especially given the notoriety of the player involved, unless they had pretty firm evidence.
Well,
to be going on,
they say they do, but I mean, that's something we have to wait to see.
All right, then. Promising Light says, "Dear Jim, I know you're dead, but please can you fix it for me that a bunch of Liverpool supporting Z-list celebrities get together and make a video decrying the injustice of the Suarez verdict? The one about Hicks and Gillette did cause me to laugh heartily."
This is the terrible thing about modern football, that everything, no matter right or wrong, becomes tribal.
Yeah.
I don't know what was said, and until the evidence is presented, we can't really make a judgment. But I feel really uncomfortable with United fans all siding with Everton, Liverpool fans all siding with Suarez, because really this is a lot more important than club rivalry.
I mean, yeah. Liverpool's response, though, has been pathetic. The statement, the T-shirts last night. They've got a player who's been found guilty at the moment of racially abusing another player, and they're trying to play the victim at the moment and claiming FA conspiracies and Alex Ferguson wants this and that. And Kenny Dalglish, you know, wearing a T-shirt last night and being so bullish about it. I think maybe they need to just step back a little and look at what they're saying. Because it's not acceptable.
Mm. And I think also perhaps it may have been what they, you know, if there was a misunderstanding, if Suarez had have perhaps had a private phone call to Everett or the club, you know, and they could have, on the, you know, day after the incident, he could have said, look, I'm really sorry. He could have made a significant donation to an anti-racism charity and said, look, I didn't understand it. And then it probably would have nipped it all in the bud.
Would it also be fair to say that it would have helped if they'd actually come out with the evidence when they announced the verdict? Or is there some reason that they weren't able to provide their reasoning for the 8-game ban immediately?
I think it hadn't been written up yet, is what I saw. But I could be wrong about that.
So that should be out in the next few days?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
Mm. Wouldn't they be better off by saying that he just didn't he doesn't understand it? He didn't know it was be offensive, but now he does know it's offensive, and he's sorry, instead of coming out and being so bullish about it.
Well, there you go. Now, much more to come in part two, including more from the Premier League midweek round and Blackburn Bolton. Now, up and down the nation, Tuesday night, families were huddled around their television sets, watching the exciting action from Ewood Park as Blackburn, who were just off the bottom of the Premier League table at the time, took on the team right below them, Bolton. Some said that a defeat in this one might see the Blackburn manager asked to sling his hook. But they did get beaten in what was a pretty thrilling game.
It was, yeah.
Jacob, yeah. He's still there, though.
He, at the time of recording, he's still there, still yeah. clinging on. I was very amused when he watching before the game, when he got off the coach and he was greeted by boos from Blackburn fans and chants, and he still had this forced grin on his face, and he was waving to his adoring public. They were really poor, though, in the first half. They didn't get a shot off until about half an hour in. They look like they're going down. I don't think they should be going down because I think they've got decent players.
They've been a little bit, I mean, obviously the problems they go much beyond this, but they were absolutely ravaged by injury before the game on Tuesday. The fact that you've got Hanley alongside Samba at the back and the two fullbacks of Pedersen and Jason Lowe, neither of whom are fullbacks. I mean, Jason Lowe was England's captain in the under-20s World Cup, playing in the middle of midfield. So I don't know where he considers his real position to be, but he doesn't look like a fullback.
No.
And Salgado obviously out as well. Xive, who's the other player out? Oh, Dan. Very unfortunate injury.
But as you say, they should have had a penalty in the second half when it was 2-1.
Foul on Goodwillie by Paul Robinson. Right. It was a penalty, I think. But it would have hidden a lot of flaws.
And well done. It was kind of
uncomfortable viewing, though, because they were the booing and the abuse.
I think Blackburn, one of their problems this year, and this is where Keane really has to take responsibility, they've dropped, I think, 9 points in the final 10 minutes of matches. This was all Sunderland's problem under Steve Bruce as well. And that's got to be a fitness issue, whether it's physical or mental. And I think you saw this on Tuesday as well, that, OK, they were already losing 2-1. But there was no great siege in the last 10 minutes.
Did you not think? There were plenty of
chances. There was a couple of chances, but it wasn't sort of camping in the Bolton half. It wasn't pounding on the door, as you would expect.
Bolton could have scored again.
And they had break after break after break. Yeah. That issue, Bolton in the first half, every time they got wide, they got crosses in.
Yeah, Petrov.
And you didn't really see that in the second half because Blackburn playing so high up, which I guess is the way to get around. Yeah, if you've got midfielders at the back, well, push them out of the field, let them play almost as midfielders. But Bolton broke and broke and broke again. They could easily have scored 4 goals on the break in that second half.
You've got problems when Rio Coca's running midfield against you.
Well, yeah.
You have to feel slightly sorry for Steve Keane.
You do.
Just the fact when you've got the Lancashire Evening Telegraph telling him to go and Jack Straw chipping in and the abuse he gets. Now, I don't think he's helped himself with some of his pronouncements earlier in the season and when he took over
he took the job as well.
Well, possibly, although I think that's part of the Fergie Northwest Mafia. The managers have got it a bit against them there.
I think it goes way beyond that. I mean, I know managers who are in no way connected to Fergie who feel very uncomfortable about that. The fact is, Keane was Jerome Anderson's man. Jerome Anderson was acting as an advisor to the club. Sam Allardyce left the job because his transfer targets, he was told you can't go for any of them, you've got to go for this list of Anderson, Cantaro players. And I think this is the problem Benkies now have. I think they were very naive when they came in. They believed what the advisors they had then told them. And then when they got rid of those advisors, they now just don't trust anybody. And now they've turned to Panisa Harvey, which isn't going to help.
I mean, the thing, I guess, is, well, who would want the Blackburn job? given that you've got Venky's the owner, there doesn't seem to be a lot of money sloshing about. I sort of backed Blackburn to go down at 4-1 the start of the season. They were 16-1 to finish bottom, and that's looking quite good at the moment, he says, picking up a trumpet. But who would take that job now?
I would love it.
They were chanting for Mark Hughes on Tuesday night, but no, he wouldn't take it.
You know, he's left. I know that they've made a few inquiries to various managers because they clearly want him to go. But who's going to take that job?
Well, the issue with Mark Hughes, if he were to go there, you've then got Keir Drabchin and Peniza Harvey near the same club, which would be hilarious to watch, but it wouldn't be good for Blackburn.
Wow.
They should have got Martin O'Neill.
I'm very happy that he's at Sunderland.
Right. Two cracking games on the Wednesday night. Sunderland and one of them, Newcastle in the other.
2 points in my last six games, Newcastle.
Mm.
Oh, Sunderland only 10 points behind them. We can do this.
Jonathan, these are exciting times, the O'Neill effect. It's real.
Well, I think what has happened, and it's exactly what I was saying about under Bruce, they conceded a lot of goals in the last 10 minutes. Well, under O'Neill already, they've picked up 5 points in the last 10 minutes of games in three matches. Now, that can't be physical fitness that he's improved already, so it must be mental fitness. He must have just encouraged them to kind of keep going, not to get disheartened.
Are there late substitutions involved?
I don't think particularly. I think it's just that they have a little bit more belief. They do keep hammering on the door.
Right.
And also that they've learned how to take corners, which some of them have been able to do in living memory, which is a great thing.
That's good then. Meantime, Newcastle against West Brom. Equally thrilling. As you mentioned, it's a rotten run of results for them. No wins in six. And they came up against a West Brom side that's really clicking now.
Possibly. I think a lot of it shows that I think Newcastle's done much better than we all thought. But Newcastle's squad is pretty thin. And once you lose two or three players, they aren't as good as they'd hoped to be.
It's that back four, isn't it? That was their great strength. Colaccini got the injury, and I know he's back now. Then Stephen Taylor's out for the rest of the season, and that unit's been broken up.
No Kabaye as well last night.
No Kabaye.
When you've got Tioti and Kabaye in that centre midfield with a strong back four, you can see very few goals, and you're always going to have a chance to win the games. With a couple of players out, suddenly they are more open. But Barr again, you've got to give him credit. Another couple. And that's the second time in the season he scored two goals in Newcastle.
They're really good goals as well.
Yeah,
but at home to West Brom, I say well done, West Brom. Now we mentioned QPR Sunderland. Tick that box. Well, let's finish off, shall we, the midweek games with Arsenal. They're back on not Boxing Day because of a tube strike in London. They're meant to be hosting Wolves at the Emirates. That's going to be the next day, is that right, Sean? Yep. But in the meantime, they went to Villa Park and came home happy with a 2-1 win.
Absolutely, and it means Villa are certainly beginning to look a little bit... not a huge amount of trouble, but a little amount of trouble they've got.
They're outside the top half for the first time this season.
They've got difficult games coming up. I think Stoke and Chelsea, if memory serves.
They have to go to Britannia, and then Chelsea.
And they could easily lose both of those games, and I think the pressure will be on... That's McLeish. It doesn't help. Exogu has been in and out of the side and hasn't played particularly well. Bent has barely scored this season. You wouldn't expect them to go down given the teams below them, but they're clearly underperforming.
5 points between them and the bottom three at the moment, but a lot of teams beginning to pick up a bit of form at the moment, so you might want to be concerned.
Well, I think they were 16-1 to go down, which as
did I ask you what the odds were on them going down?
No, I just thought it'd let you know.
They have real problems defending corners as well. And last night they let Yossi Banyan score a header from a corner, and against Liverpool as well they let in two. So
they're absolutely awful against Liverpool.
Well, they've been pitiful every time I've seen them this season. They're currently the worst team to watch in the league.
Are you suggesting that Benny Yoon scoring a corner is something really, really, really poor?
Yeah, he's a small player. You wouldn't think
Arsenal
that...
scoring a corner.
Even Wenger said it was. Wenger said it's historic for us to score from two set pieces.
Magnificent. All right. Well, problems then at Villa. Well, that's the midweek. That's the midweek action. Then apologies if we didn't get on to your team. But of course, a big round of Boxing Day matches and Tuesday too, and we'll be rounding all that up. Is it next Thursday we're back?
It is, yeah.
All right then. Mark TG posts in and says, I do find the continued assertion that the Rock of Gibraltar issue led to the Glazers' arrival not just tired, but ill thought out. Ouch. It only works if we make the rather bizarre assumptions that A, all the people who sold shares to Magny and McManus after the row with Fergie was public and they were trying to increase their stake for some reason wouldn't have sold to the Glazers, and B, that the hard-nosed businessmen they showed themselves to be, Magny and McManus, for some reason wouldn't have sold their stake to the Glazers for a healthy profit, and had there not been a row. I do kind of get what you're saying there, Mark TG. I don't know.
I don't know.
No, nobody does. So, yeah. But I thought we'd mention that because we mentioned that on Monday, you know. Okay. Now, finish off part two. Hey ho, Serie A. Oh, dearie, dearie me. All sorts of upsetting scenes in the last few days. Cristiano Doni's arrest, which featured him, the former Italy midfielder, trying to hide behind his Porsche in his garage so that the police wouldn't find him. But he was taken in, and it does look like this one is going to absolutely explode. It did seem as though this was merely the police follow-up to the initial last bet scandal back in the summer, which led to Atalanta starting the season with a six-point penalty. But there's a lot of gas, to use Barry's expression, left in this particular explosion, particularly because there's a lot of suggestions that some of the people who have been taken in already, and there's a whole bundle of former players, are actually going to start spilling the beans. One chap indeed already has been, Vittorio Micolucci, a former Ascoli player, who explains how the whole match-fixing thing. You'll enjoy this, Sean. Basically, there's this group called the Zingari, which means the gypsies. They would go around with wads of euro notes, and basically they would wave 50,000 of these under a player's nose and say, these are yours if you can give us the overs or unders on the game. If you can get us the correct score, goes up to 100,000. And they would basically pay off. This is according to Micolucci. Players all over, largely Serie B, although I was somewhat chilled to read today in Gazzetta that I think there's at least 20 Serie A matches from last season that are also under investigation. And at the centre of it, well, there's two different groups. I mean, you've got the Zingari with Signori. And that's one of the things I think about this. You know, Luciano Moggi, when he went down, we all knew there was something very wrong about him. But when it's Beppe Signori and Cristiano Doni, you know, a little bit of your childhood dies.
I mean, I was chatting to Gabriel Marcotti of rival podcast, The Game, about this, and he was sort of...
I don't think rival. I think complimentary.
Complimentary, exactly.
Co-podcaster.
I mean, he doesn't think football podcasts should be funny. He's very, very clear on that, but that's a subject for another day.
Why is that?
It's one for another. He thinks football's...
Just... job.
Why?
Well, he thinks football's a serious business, and no,
it's
fair
not.
Play to him.
Right. It was a game last time I looked.
But anyway, his point was that, you know, if what they try and do is get at least two, with two players, that then you can start fixing a game. Whether it's, you know, particularly if you're looking at goalkeepers or, you know, defenders, they're more chance, especially when you're looking at overs and unders, goal bets. But yeah, at the same time, though, that's not quite enough. You know, he was telling me a comical story about the player who ended up doping his teammates to try and get the overs and unders work, because he kept losing his bets.
Yeah, and they kept winning. And they won this game that they'd been doped for, except one of his teammates almost had a very serious car accident on the way home because he was too doped up to drive. It was an appalling story, and that guy was one of the reasons that the whole story began to break, because his wiretaps were so incriminatory?
It was a play for Lecce.
Cremonese. Doni, in the meantime, who was, as I say, hiding behind the Porsche in his garage to try and avoid the police, equally, his wiretaps don't display any great knowledge of how to avoid police interceptions. But he's recorded talking to one of his associates saying, do a funny voice when you talk to them so you can't be identified. So... bless.
Do you mean now, if you've seen The Wire, everybody knows you just get a mobile phone, chuck it out the window, and then somebody else can pick it up and use it?
Yeah. Well, what he was doing, and actually this brings us on to another thing, what he was doing was he was putting in a special Romanian SIM card into his phone when he would make special calls, which he regarded as untraceable. Sadly for him, it didn't prove to be. But one of the people that he called up was a guy who was the sporting director before a game against Padova, that's already under some suspicion. And this... has now led to the investigators to suggest that there was actually an agreement between clubs there. This wasn't a case of these Zingari people going around waving money, turning up at team hotels before games and buying out players. But there actually was collusion between clubs. If that was the case, if this is proved, obviously this has massive implications for Atalanta, who are currently, I think, in 11th place in Serie A. Doni coming in now, the question, will he spill the beans? Because he's been at the start of at the center of so many stories, you know, going back 10 years of betting scandals and trials and things that he's always come out of okay until this last summer. This whole thing looks like it could get very, very large indeed.
But you've always stuck up for Serie A, you, as rightly so, but this is quite damaging, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
But it's not. But at the same time, it's not a surprise, because you know, you have to look at the odds, and you know, with two, three,
well, everybody knows that
there's a draw comes hugely odds on.
Three quarters of the way through the season, that there are certain games that you should never in your right mind bet on. But this goes a bit beyond that. We'll have to see. But as Jonathan says, you have to see.
But it's only an extra bit of cream on a very fruity cake.
Sour cream, I call it. And the worst thing is that this is all coming at a time when, in many ways, Serie A is really bouncing back. And brilliant midweek round in Italy. 31 goals scored. Napoli beating Genoa 6-1. Parma with another six-goal thriller, second in a row. And you've got Milan and Juve neck and neck at the top of the table, and then Udinese, Lazio, and Inter right back in the thick of it as well.
And we should say a little bit about Roma. With you know, Enrique, yeah, everyone thought he was a goer, off the chop. But the last couple of games,
I'm going to eat my panettone in everyone's face, as Luis Enrique said. Yeah, it's the way I like to do it as well. And I'm going to eat my Pandoro as well.
What's the best panettone, Jimbo?
The best panettone was the only. There was one that I had that spoiled all other panettones for me, and it was made by some baker bloke in Abruzzo. I don't know who. Somebody gave it to me. They said their father owned a factory in Abruzzo, and he said, oh, yeah, he gets this bloke to make. And it was really tall. It was, like, way taller than any of the usual ones. It was like, how high would that be? Half a metre high? But tall and thin. Yeah. It was astonishing. It was it was bitter, but in the right way, like a good marmalade is bitter. None of this sweet stuff.
So it's almost like when you kiss, you know, who you think are the most beautiful girl in the world, and every other kiss after that's not going to be quite the same.
No, it's better than that. Yeah. Anyway.
A cake better than a kiss from a beautiful woman?
Well, it was a very special cake. We mentioned panettone eating it. Devis Manja didn't eat his. And a lot of people saying it's ironic because Manja means eat, and he didn't get to. He even brought a panettone to the press conference just before he got fired, saying, look, I am going to have my panettone. And then he got fired, but he was working for Zamperini at Palermo, so what did he expect? Anyway, that's enough Serie A for now. Jonathan, you've now got to get your train to Sunderland.
I do. It's been lovely. Thank you very much. Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Jonathan. Take your mince pie.
No, you can have that mince pie. It'll just get crummy on the journey.
All right, then. Well, have a super Christmas, Jonathan.
You too. Thank you very much.
And we're going to take a break and come back with part three after this. Right, now part three starts in exciting fashion as we catch up with our chum Rutger Slachter of Eredivisie Live to talk a little bit about the situation in the Eredivisie as they head off into their extended winter break, not until the 22nd of January. But boy, did they go out with a bang. Rutger, everyone talking. Hello there, by the way.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, yourself?
Yeah, I'm doing fine.
Good. Now, everybody's talking about the Dutch Cup tie this week between Ajax and AZ Alkmaar. Is everyone talking about it in Holland too?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, quite unique actually. We were talking this morning that, I mean, I can't remember a lot of incidents over the last 20 years where something like this happened, and everybody was just flabbergasted that it was still possible for a supporter, a hooligan, to come out on the pitch.
For anyone who didn't see it, he's basically looking upfield, the goalkeeper at the time. I think he's just kicked the ball upfield, and just as this fan races towards him, he notices him, and as the fan tries to kick him, he kind of kicks the fan to the floor, and then absolutely lays into him a couple of times, really giving it what you'd have to term some welly, before being sort of hustled away by teammates, and then the somewhat bewildered referee shows him a red card in a similar incident to the one recently in the Russian Football League, which saw a player sent off despite the fact that they'd actually been attacked. So a couple of questions. First of all, has there been an outcry about the red card? And two, who is this fan and why was he trying to attack the goalkeeper in the first place?
Well, apparently he was holding a grudge against the goalkeeper, or at least this is what he said afterwards. But basically, he was just a drunk 19-year-old calling himself an Ajax supporter, but obviously just a hooligan. And he just saw an opportunity, and the Ajax arena, I'm actually looking at it right now from where I'm sitting, it's quite secure and safe, and the harder supporters, the firms, are sitting on the opposite side of the stadium. But this side, you have the platform for wheelchairs and stuff like that. And he was able to cross a fence there and walk across that platform and enter the pitch. But basically, he was just a nutcase who was drunk, probably.
Right. So after Esteban got sent off, then the whole AZ Alkmaar team left the field in protest.
Yeah.
Are they going to be penalised about that, or is there support for them?
That's the discussion right now, what's going to happen, because AZ Alkmaar is saying that they didn't feel safe anymore out on the pitch, and rightly so. I mean, if people are able to enter the pitch. But I've got a feeling that perhaps if the red card wouldn't have been shown, that perhaps they would have played on. That was just ridiculous, of course. Apparently, it is according to the law that the goalkeeper had an act of violence on the pitch and should be sent off. But if you out there you see what's happening, you shouldn't have sent them away, of course. Perhaps, go inside, take a couple of minutes, and then within 15, 30 minutes they were able again to play. But because of that red card, I don't think that Alkmaar felt like playing on, and they felt wrong. And after seeing the incident, you got to feel for the goalkeeper as well. I mean, like you said, he was just attacked from behind and was lucky to escape serious injury, I think.
Yeah.
So you got to feel for the guy.
Absolutely. A terrible story, but it's otherwise been a brilliant start to the season for Alkmaar. Top of the table, and they've really bounced back from their recent problems.
Yeah, they have. Everybody is quite surprised by that, because a couple of years ago, of course, they were champions of Holland when Louis van Gaal was still coach there. And then they had problems with the owner, financial problems, you name it. And this year, under coach Verbeek, they're doing really well. It is a pity for Alkmaar that the 2011 is just like a month too long, because they did drop a couple of points in the last couple of matches. And now it's quite close again, and also Ajax and Feyenoord joining at the top again. So the first 5, 6, 7 clubs are really close together. Mm. So it's really an exciting competition this year, and it's just a shame that we go out with a bang, like you said.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you come back with a bang as well, because AZ are going to be taking on Ajax in their first game back on the 22nd
of
January.
So there's going to be a lot of tension before that game. And obviously, we'll have to wait and see what the Dutch FA is going to decide about this game, when it will be played again. Because if they decide that, the game should be played again or start over at the 37th minute when the incident happened, perhaps that's going to be before the next league game, of course. So we just got to wait and see. I think there are three options for the Dutch FA. Either, kick out Ajax out of the tournament, play it again from scratch, 90 minutes, or the remainder of the game. So we've got to wait and see on that one.
All right then, Roger. Well, listen, thanks very much for talking us through it today. Have a super Christmas, and hopefully catch up with you after then.
I'm looking forward to that.
You can also tell us about Van Gaal and the extraordinary situation there with Cruyff at Ajax.
That's also quite a story.
Yeah, all right, nice one. Thanks, Roger. Speak to you after Christmas then.
You're welcome.
So there you go. It is an amazing situation there with Van Gaal and Cruyff suing his fellow board members at Ajax to stop them hiring Van Gaal as a director. And that was the last time I saw it. I don't know what the latest is. But anyway, apologies for the sound on that phone line, but extraordinary story. Apologies for the sound on this phone line now, because we're going to dial up Sid Lowe, which always means some kind of phonic misadventures. Sid, are you there?
Hello, James. I'm here. How are you?
I'm well. Jacob Steinberg's well. Sean Ingalls, well. Jonathan's on a train. Ironically,
James, were you missing the word hard out from all of those? Sean Ingalls, well, hard. Jacob Steinberg's well, hard.
What's your point? They're both quite ripped, actually. Sean is
Sean's rock.
He is rock, actually.
Just
yeah.
to make Jimbo feel at home. Now he's seen the world's strongest man.
Hey, I see where you're all heading with this. I do see.
How does it feel to be back on our nation's domestic TV channels?
Don't call it a comeback, Sean Ingle. It's lovely. But the real bit, if you are following World's Strongest Man, very exciting. But these are only the qualifying rounds, which I didn't really have any participation in. But the bit that I was there for is the bit that comes up after. I think it starts on the 27th. The actual bit at Wingate University in North Carolina. Wow.
Did they do funny things? Because back in the day with the presenters, they used to sort of lift the presenters over their heads and do strange things with them. Are you involved in any of that?
You just have to wait and see, Sean. The kind of crazy...
Pressing Jimbo for reps.
Yeah, that kind of thing. It's more the kind of thing rugby players would do.
I quite like the idea of them pulling Jimbo along with their teeth. That would be good.
Right, yeah.
What part of Jimbo?
Yeah.
Anyway. Easy, this isn't the word. It's World's Strongest Man.
Exactly. Now, Sid Lowe. I put it to you that Iniesta's team has just put Atletico Madrid out of the Copa del Rey. I'm not ordinarily interested in the Copa del Rey, but that did sound quite exciting to me. He owns this team.
Yeah, I'm not normally interested in the Copa del Rey, but this year it's been really quite good. The Copa del Rey, for those that don't know, is slightly ruined every year by the Spanish Football Federation, by the way that they kind of manage the draws. It's two-legged. They make sure that the second division B teams play teams that are in Europe to make it as easy as possible for them. They try and make it basically so that there's no shocks. But every year someone manages to keep some sense of the competition being worthwhile alive. And this time around, quite a few of them. Atletico Madrid, you say, knocked out by Albacete, who these days have Andres Iniesta amongst their shareholders.
He's the number one shareholder, isn't he?
He's the majority shareholder, yeah. I think, yeah.
Cool.
Last night as well, Villarreal were knocked out by second division B side Mirandés, the only team in the whole of Spain unbeaten in all competitions this season. Villarreal are out. That means that Juan Carlos Garrido is out of a job. He's been sacked. Betis went out as well, and sadly, unfortunately, Athletic Bilbao didn't go out. They managed to get through against Real Oviedo.
Oh, that is a shame. But you mentioned the Villarreal manager going. What about Atletico Madrid's boss?
Well, he's gone already. The question is when they actually formalise that. He said himself, and I think he's absolutely right, Gregorio Manzano, which day was it? I think it was the day before the game, sort of in Tuesday. He said, "Do you think it's ethical that you lot, i.e. the media, know that I've been sacked and I don't?" And of course the answer is no, of course it's not ethical, but this is Atletico Madrid.
Sid, can I ask about Rafa Benitez? Any possibility he might head there?
Well, I must admit, I don't think it... Well, it's certainly not going to happen now, and I don't think it'll happen in the short to medium term.
I thought it was Diego Simeone.
It's not going to happen now because it's going to be... Exactly, because it's going to be Cholo Simeone who's going to turn up. He pulled out of his job in Argentina. He's on his way to Atletico Madrid. He's always said that he wants to coach the club. Bizarrely enough, he played as a player at Atletico Madrid twice, and the second time, part of that spell was spent under Gregorio Manzano as coach. The reason why Benitez in the short and medium term, I think, is that Benitez demands, quite rightly, a degree of control and seriousness about the work, which I think he knows at Atletico Madrid he'd never get.
All right. Sid, when's the Liga back?
The Liga is back in the second weekend of January, James.
Brilliant. Okay. And in the meantime, I bet there's all sorts of big transfer stories beginning to bubble away there. We have Simba is a Red asking, can you ask Sid Lowe about rumours linking Mesut Ozil away from Madrid on the next pod? Any other? Can you give me any word on that and any other stories that might be on the horizon?
Well, one thing that is true is that Mesut Ozil is at the moment in a position in which he looks like he may well be about to lose his place either to Kaká or maybe even to Angel Di Maria with Callejon coming into the side. He hasn't particularly enamoured himself to Jose Mourinho with the way that he played in the last Clásico. There's a slight concern about his kind of all-round drop in form. But I don't think for one minute that he's going to go during this winter window. I'd be very, very surprised if he does. The summer, well, I think it's too early to say anything about summer. Madrid's intention, initially at least, was that he would become their next really, really great player.
All right. But they don't feel that's working out.
Well, at the moment, it's not looking great. But as I say, he will not be going during this winter window, right. I don't think. And then, of course, by the summer, then all sorts of things could have changed by then.
Who will be going, Sid, do you think? Or coming?
Well, it's interesting. Real Madrid, they're looking for a right back because, of course, one of the big reasons why their form improved this year was the moving of Sergio Ramos from right back to centre back, and I think gave them much more pace and much more aggressiveness in the middle of the defence, and therefore that left them in a position where they felt they needed to seek out a right back. They've played with Álvaro Arbeloa there, which is obviously a perfectly logical solution. They've played with Lassana Diarra there, which has worked relatively well. They've played with Fabio Coentrao there, which didn't really work at all. Although I think Coentrao's probably taken a bit more criticism than perhaps he deserves. So I think Madrid now do want a right back. Talking about a couple of Brazilians at the moment, but I think that's the one move that I expect Real Madrid to make. I don't expect Barcelona to make any. I expect there to be quite a lot of comings and goings at Atletico Madrid because they've been saying literally 2 or 3 minutes ago, just before I took the call from you, there was statement from Atletico Madrid's president saying, yes, there will be changes and it won't just necessarily be the coach. So I think we may see a couple of players going. Jose Antonio Reyes will leave and go back to Sevilla, which he should probably never have left in the first place when he went to Arsenal. When was it? Back in 2003 or 2004? But I don't expect to see a huge amount of big movement, certainly for the big two clubs anyway.
It won't be Fernando Torres going back to Atletico, will it?
I don't see it, and I don't see it because Torres' relationship with the current owners isn't that great. Atletico Madrid don't have the money to do it, so unless there was some sort of deal involving other players, maybe Falcao, but I just don't see that happening. And also, I think when you look at Torres' situation, Torres is about to get the opportunity to rescue, you know, the situation at Chelsea, which is when Drogba goes off the African Cup of Nations.
Fair enough. Sid, how are you going to spend your Christmas?
Hopefully getting fat.
Right. Where, Sid? And on what?
On what?
Yeah.
Well,
where are you going to be? Are you going to be in Spain or in England? Where are you going
to be? Oh, no, I'll be in Spain for Christmas.
Oh, lovely. What kind of thing will you do?
I imagine I will sit in front of the telly and eat things, and chances are I'll probably do quite a lot of work and you know, a bit of everything as usual.
Oh, Latins.
Maybe I'll even take Estella for a walk if she's very, very good.
Oh, lovely. Magnificent. All right, Sid, well, have a super time. Let's hope Santa brings you everything you want and need. And we'll catch up with you afterwards. Hmm?
Fantastic. Have a great Christmas. Cheerio.
Feliz Navidad. And with that, he went. Well, then, that's it, isn't it, Jacob?
Is it?
It is.
Okay.
It quite clearly is. That's it for, indeed, this week and the start of next week. We'll be back on Thursday, just after all that glut of post-Christmas games. And looking forward to another glut around the new year period. And who knows where we'll be by then in terms of teams doing what to each other. But in the meantime, have a super Christmas all. Many thanks to guest producer Matt Hill, who I think has ended his guest stint with this one. He's waving. Sean Ingle, look forward to seeing you in the new year. You ripped, glistening specimen you. And same to you, Jacob Steinberg.
Thank you.
There will be a series of videos actually up in our place on Monday, if you're feeling you'd like to hear from us on Boxing Day. And, of course, Friday, we'll see the final Euro pay-per-view of 2011. So do log on to that. But for now, from all of us here, it's have a super Christmas, and we'll speak to you Thursday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio. The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.